This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 133, Diadochoi, aka Meet the Neighbors Number 2. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed the short episode last time. It was just a quick little survey of the Eleusinian mysteries and the idea of ancient mystery cults in general, just to get that idea in your heads. Before that, we were busy for a while. The friends and generals of Alexander the Great have been tearing the late king's empire apart at the seams for years now, and the actual royal family was powerless to stop them, in part because everyone kept getting assassinated. We left episode 131 with the death of the 14-year-old King Alexander IV and his mother Roxane, which brought a sudden, violent end to Macedon's ancient Agiad dynasty. All of a sudden, the empire just kinda didn't have a head of state. Officially, all of the power players were still satraps and strategoi, governing under Alexander IV's permission. Technically, as dictated by his regent Cassander. In practice, Cassander, Ptolemy, Lysimachus, Antigonus, and Seleucus, as well as the various other contenders who have been defeated or killed, were acting as autonomous warlords, and had been since the death of Cassander's father Antipater a decade earlier. This episode presented a little problem for me when I sat down to figure out how it would fit in to the overall narrative of this podcast. As a general rule, I am focused on the rulers of Persia and Ecbatana, which meant the Macedonians at large for a few episodes, then Antigonus, and now Seleucus. But I still have to cover one of the more important political shifts in the empire's history, even though Seleucus isn't involved at all. Thus, we use the Meet the Neighbors format. It fits in conveniently as the follow-up episode for Alexander IV. Today, I will explain how we go from a single giant empire surrounded by petty kingdoms and nomadic tribes to just one great kingdom in a sprawling sea of imperial powers, because King Alexander still needs his successors. Alexander IV was killed in late 309 BCE, but rather than setting off a dramatic powder keg, all five of the major players just continued business as usual. Seleucus was consolidating his power after seizing control of Babylon and the upper satrapies, and would stay that way for several years. Antigonus was also recovering and desperately trying to fend off his western colleagues as they pilfered his Greek vassals. Ptolemy was working hard to seize absolute control of Cyprus and harass Antigonus however possible, without officially violating the peace they established after their last war. Cassander was fighting the Epirotes and the Illyrians on his western front, Lysimachus was fighting the Odrysian kingdom up in Thrace, and they all just kept to this holding pattern. Ptolemy was the first to really test the waters. About a year after Alexander IV's assassination, he sent the Egyptian navy to besiege and raid the coast of Cilicia and Halicarnassus. As a Carian Greek city, Halicarnassus was technically independent, although obviously in Antigonus's sphere of influence. So Ptolemy could claim plausible deniability. That said, although the city was strategically important to regional politics and symbolically important as the place where Ptolemy himself first achieved military fame, it didn't make any sense as a first strike in a new war. Halicarnassus was too well defended and too easily surrounded to make for a useful beachhead, and a genuine war effort would have been better served by assaulting the ports of Cilicia and Phoenicia with more force. Ptolemy was just trying to provoke a response. Antigonus, still on his way back from Mesopotamia at the time, sent his son Demetrius to run the Ptolemaic invaders out of their territory. This worked and earned Demetrius general praise and fame across the wider Mediterranean world. It's also a possibility that the siege of Halicarnassus was intended in part to help facilitate Ptolemy's marriage proposal. Cleopatra, the full-blooded younger sister of Alexander the Great, was still in Sardis, where she had been for the last 14 years of intermittent civil wars ever since fleeing there from Epirus with her mother Olympias. As the closest living relative to Alexander the Great, she also carried the last hope of claiming legitimacy through the old dynasty, and every contender for power in the West wanted to marry Princess Cleopatra. She chose Ptolemy, and arranged plans to make her escape from Lydia to Egypt. Unfortunately for Cleopatra, Antigonus found out about it in advance and had the last of the Augead royals assassinated. And then he executed the maids he had used as scapegoats. Antigonus and son Imperial Inc. took an important lesson from this encounter at Halicarnassus, though. They decided that A, the Greek cities were supposed to be independent according to the policy of freedom of the Greeks that everyone had officially signed on to, and B, Athens was looking awfully not independent these days. After Athens was subdued in the Lamian War, Cassander appointed another Demetrius, Demetrius Phalaris, to rule the city as Macedonian governor. Phalaris was an esteemed statesman and philosopher in Athens and enjoyed some initial public support. But as most of Greece took advantage of the freedom policies, the Macedonian governor transitioned into basically the exact same role as a classical tyrant. The city was still home to one of Cassander's garrisons, and was effectively Antipatrid territory in all but the flimsiest of pretexts. Antigonus also had to prepare for the inevitable war with Ptolemaic Egypt. So, fresh off this victory at Halicarnassus, Demetrius was placed in charge of the Antigonid fleet, now swollen to 250 ships from the Anatolian Greeks and Phoenician city-states. It was, effectively, an Achaemenid royal navy reborn, and they would finally do the one thing the Persians had always hesitated or failed to actually do themselves. They loaded their cargo holds with 500 talents of gold for bribes, mercenaries, and supplies, then gunned it straight for Athens. At this stage, everyone was still expecting Ptolemy to make the first move, so when a fleet of war arrived in the Piraeus, the Athenians thought it was the Egyptians. Demetrius Phalaris ordered the Athenian militia to take up arms just in case Ptolemy was betraying Cassander, but he did not try to defend the harbor since Ptolemy was technically still an ally until proven otherwise. Of course, it wasn't Ptolemy. It was the younger Demetrius, who promptly announced that he was there to liberate Athens and give freedom to the Greeks. The Athenian militia promptly threw down their shields in a sign of surrender, and Phalaris's allies in the city largely abandoned him, offering their services to the Antigonids instead. Phalaris didn't resist, and the younger Demetrius had some soldiers escort the now evicted governor to Thebes unharmed, leaving the Macedonian garrison outside the Piraeus cut off from Cassander entirely as the Athenians and Antigonid troops besieged their fortress. Since Athens was so eager to help the Antigonid cause, if it meant restoring democratic governance, Demetrius was able to mostly leave them to it and take most of his fleet west to Megara, the nearest Antipatrid garrison standing. Then, in his biography of Demetrius, Plutarch offers one of the funnier stories from ancient history I've ever seen. Let me just read it to you. But on learning that Chrysopolis, who had been the wife of Polyperchon's son, was tarrying at Patrae, and would be very glad to make him a visit, and she was a most famous beauty, he left his forces in the territory of Megara and set forth, taking a few light-armed attendants with him. And turning aside from these as well, he pitched his tent apart, so that the woman might pay her visit to him unobserved. So, a beautiful, young, rich, and well-connected widow made a booty call, and the 29-year-old Demetrius snuck off from his siege, then snuck off from his bodyguards to answer. I gotta wonder, just a little, was pitching a tent a euphemism back then, too? It feels like it should have been. Anyway, some of Cassander's men in the area caught word of this little escapade and tracked Demetrius down before Cratisopolis could arrive. Demetrius ran back to his guards in terror and fled the area, leaving all of his personal possessions behind in his hookup tent to be captured by the enemy. Gods, the look on Antigonus's face when he heard about this must have been priceless. On one hand, I'm about the same age, and every step of this process sounds like a dumber and dumber idea to me, sitting here at my desk reading objectively. On the other hand, hot young wealthy widow. I get it. Fortunately, this embarrassing little incident didn't cause too much trouble, and the Antigonids captured Megara without issue. Once again, I want to read from Plutarch, because despite coming off as exceedingly arrogant a lot of the time, sometimes this guy is just really witty. While he was still engaged in this, Demetrius thought himself of Stilpo the philosopher, who was famous for his election to a life of tranquility. Accordingly, Demetrius summoned him and asked him whether anyone had robbed him of anything. No one, said Stilpo, for I saw nobody carrying away knowledge. But nearly all the servants in the city were stolen away. And when Demetrius tried once more to deal kindly with the philosopher, and finally on going away, he said, Your city, Stilpo, I leave in freedom. You speak true, Stilpo replied, for you haven't left a single one of our slaves. Now, of course, these slaves had not been freed. They were just taken into slavery by somebody else and likely sold as war profits. But it's still a good line. Demetrius got back to Athens just in time for his troops to break through the Antipatrid defenses and level the Macedonian garrison, as a sign that Antigonus did not want to impose tyrannical rule on the Greeks any longer. The city-state was allowed to restore its democratic government, and Demetrius and his father were honored beyond even their most megalomaniacal dreams. First, the Democrats of Athens proclaimed them, father and son alike, to be kings. Then, they proclaimed them to be gods. To be clear, this wasn't placing Antigonus and Demetrius on the level of Zeus, or even the more popular lesser gods like Heracles. It was more a declaration that, even before they died, Antigonus and Demetrius would be honored with a heroic cult, a sort of worship typically reserved for the most beloved and deceased local champions and mythological characters. This decision by the Athenians was, ultimately, one of the root causes for the later Roman imperial cult of worshiping the emperors as gods when they died, and thereby honoring the royal family. The Athenians immediately started making plans to incorporate the Antigonid king's portraits into the gold weave adorning the idol statue of Athena in their central temple, and to build an altar on the spot where Demetrius first set foot inside the city. The Athenians also bestowed their new democracy-granting kings with the epithet Soter, meaning savior, usually reserved for gods up to this point in Greek history. Then it went a little bit off the rails as Athenian aristocrats started trying to outdo one another in pursuit of Demetrius's favor, with increasingly elaborate and deifying acts of submission to their liberator, up to the point that some Athenians sent envoys to offer sacrifices before Demetrius himself as they would at a temple altar. According to Plutarch, this went to the young king's head, and that meant that he really did not want to leave when his father summoned him to start a war against Ptolemy in earnest that next spring. Demetrius tried to bribe Ptolemy's men who had occupied the Isthmus of Corinth, but they refused, and Demetrius was forced to put his dreams of fame and worship all over Greece on hold. He took the Antigonid fleet to Cyprus instead. For all the concern that Ptolemy would strike first, the ruler of Egypt was biding his time, and Antigonus decided he was going to force the issue. Demetrius arrived and drove Ptolemy's brother Menelaus back into Cypriot Salamis with relative ease, allowing the Antigonids to land and start occupying Cypriot cities before besieging Salamis. Then Ptolemy arrived, with every intention of reminding the other Macedonian potentates why the oldest and grandest evidence of imperial power was in his territory and not theirs. With only Egypt at his back, Ptolemy assembled a fleet and army comparable to his opponents, even after Demetrius recruited reinforcements in Cilicia. Demetrius made a counteroffer. He would let Ptolemy escape if he surrendered his occupied cities in Greece. With all eyes in the Western Empire now fixed on Cyprus, the land and sea around Salamis exploded. Demetrius's besieging army on land turned to face Ptolemy, and a battle of over 400 ships swarmed across the waves. On land, Demetrius once again deployed the highly aggressive tactics that had proven so effective against Ptolemy in the past and routed the Egyptian army, forcing Ptolemy himself to flee and take his only slightly less battered fleet with him. But the numerous cargo ships, the ones with all of Ptolemy's camp followers, money, and siege weapons, had to be left behind, as did his brother Menelaus, who wasn't able to escape the blockade of Salamis. Demetrius claimed over 12,000 prisoners of war and loot beyond counting, yielding Cyprus to the Antigonids in a single battle. And we will follow up on the aftermath of that battle after a short break. You know what can be really scary? Learning a new language. Whenever I've attempted to learn languages the traditional academic way, I've spent a semester or four drowning in random vocabulary and seemingly arbitrary grammar before I even start to get the hang of it. That's part of why Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, with 30 years of experience and millions of users conveniently available on desktop or mobile apps. It immerses you in a new language, whether you're like me and working on it for your career or school, or it's something more recreational. There are over 25 languages available to learn, from Spanish to Arabic and Persian to Chinese. Their system focuses on fast, natural language acquisition and long-term retention, not English translations. The True Accent speech recognition feature also gives you feedback on your pronunciation to avoid any embarrassing accidents in emphasis or tone. Plus, it's an amazing value because the lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages for any future language learning needs. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. And we are back. Demetrius, the son of Antigonus, has just won a massive victory over Ptolemy and claimed Cyprus for the Antigonid cause. The courtier Aristodemus of Miletus was sent to bring word of the victory to Antigonus, anxiously awaiting news from his son. Aristodemus greeted his patron with a triumphant, "Hail Antigonus, King!" And as news of their conquest spread, Greeks and Macedonians alike started to proclaim Antigonus and his son as their new monarchs. Someone in the Antigonid court quickly got around to cutting and adorning a few ornate strips of purple fabric, and the Antigonid courtiers crowned Antigonus himself with their diadem. Another diadem was sent to Demetrius with a letter from his father, confirming his position as co-king. This presented a problem for Ptolemy, who couldn't let this one defeat give all of the legitimacy over to the Antigonids. So his courtiers also got a diadem together and proclaimed Ptolemy king as well. Then, wouldn't you know, Lysimachus started wearing a diadem and addressing his letters as a king. So did Seleucus, who, for that matter, had already been called king by the Babylonians and Iranians for a couple of years now. Of the Big Five, only Cassander refused to adopt the title or style of monarch. But that didn't stop everyone around him from addressing him as king anyway. This does raise an important question, though. What exactly were all of these guys kings of? The short answer is nothing. They didn't append any sort of location or modifier to the title. They weren't kings of Egypt, Thrace, Syria, Macedon, and Persia. They weren't great kings, kings of kings, or any of the other Achaemenid titles. They were just king. The implication in contemporary politics was king of Macedon, with each contender claiming to be the rightful Diadochos, successor of Alexander. But they all wisely kept that bit to themselves. These were, more practically, declarations of independence from one another. They may have all been holding out hope, and they had all seen enough war to know how quickly things could change, but most of them couldn't realistically have looked at political reality and thought anyone besides Cassander and Antigonus had immediate chances of actually taking and holding Pella. Ptolemy would just have had too much ground to cover. Lysimachus was perpetually stuck in his Odrysian quagmire. And Seleucus had just gotten his back door kicked in out east. More on that later. So for now, they were all just king, or to put that in Greek, Vasileus. There are still plenty of twists and turns ahead of us, but I think most listeners are at least vaguely aware that none of our players are going to successfully put all the pieces back together, if only because there were kind of famously still Ptolemies in Egypt 300 years later, and I've been referencing Seleucids for the past 5 years. However, adopting the word Basileus as a generic, unmodified title for the great rulers in 306 BC actually had far-reaching consequences for the Greek language. In the years and decades that followed, many other Hellenistic rulers claimed the royal title, including the autocratic leaders of individual city-states and smaller regions within the major kingdoms. Later generations of the Diadochoi's own successors cracked down on this, and with the exception of a few legacy offices like the Spartan dual monarchy, Basileus became a title reserved for the great rulers, while their autocratic vassals were deemed tyrants, in the same way that the Achaemenids had employed that title for their own Greek subjects. In even later centuries, Greek power will ultimately give way to Roman and Iranian rule, and Basileus was increasingly reserved for only the great rulers like the Roman Emperor and the Persian Shahanshah. What was once the simple word for king was now reserved for those who ruled other kings. In the early Roman period, when emperors pretended they weren't monarchs, official Greek documents avoided the word. But plenty of literature was much less cagey, and by the 4th century CE, that pretense started to fall away entirely. After the fall of the Western Empire, Basileus became the de facto Greek word for emperor, and regus, a Hellenized version of the Roman word rex, became the go-to for lesser kings. The genesis of that odd semantic transition begins here, with the crowning of the Diadochoi. But the war was hardly over. If anything, everyone and their cousin becoming kings just heightened tensions, and Demetrius hardly had time to count all his loot on Cyprus before sailing off to Rhodes. The large island off the coast of Caria was another Ptolemaic ally, and Demetrius spent most of 305 and the beginning of 304 besieging the island city, constructing a monstrosity of a siege tower, about 500 meters square and almost 30 tall. Even his behemoth city Caesar couldn't breach the Rhodian defenses, and Demetrius was forced to negotiate with Rhodes. Its government agreed to split allegiances. Ptolemy had been sending supplies to the Rhodians this whole time, and since he was a king in Egypt, aka a pharaoh, and thus a living god by Egyptian tradition, and he had just helped save a city, Ptolemy claimed the divine epithet Soter to further rival the Antigonids. It was barely a pretext, given the Rhodian arrangement here. They agreed to assist the Antigonids in any war, just not against Ptolemy. And with that, Demetrius went back to Athens, where he was hailed as Polyocrates, the besieger. Yes, the Athenians were such simps for their young god king that they honored him for trying and failing to take Rhodes. Ironically, he was also there to rescue Athens from a siege. Cassander was understandably furious with the Athenians' eagerness to trade his rule for the Antigonids, and marshaled the Macedonian army and navy to retake Attica while Demetrius was far away. He seized Greek Salamis off the Athenian coast and began his own assault on the Athenian walls. In a bizarre sort of reversal to Xerxes' invasion 170 years earlier, Demetrius sailed into the Straits of Salamis and drove off the attackers before landing, chasing Cassander all the way north to Thermopylae, where the northern invaders were forced to give up and flee for home while Thebes joined the side that offered freedom for the Greeks. Then Demetrius turned around and focused on liberating the Peloponnese. He did pause for a few weeks to take advantage of all the adulation and pleasure Athens had to offer. And by pleasure, I do mean the X-rated kind. It's not particularly important to the narrative, but since Plutarch is one of our primary sources and his lives are morality tales as well as biographies, I think it's worth pointing out just how much emphasis he places on this stuff. I brought up the booty call with Ctesippolis earlier, but that is just one of many pit stops in Plutarch's narrative to address just how laid Demetrius Polyocrates was getting. Plutarch brings it up constantly. Demetrius could barely stop himself from marrying every rich widow of remotely eligible age and class he came into contact with. Basically, every victory involves him adding another well-known courtesan to his retinue, and during this particular stopover in Athens, he took up the habit of hooking up with the most famous prostitutes in the city and attractive young men and older boys in the temple precinct. Plutarch is critical of this, and even I get a very strong impression that Demetrius would have been better served by occasionally thinking with his other head. That said, Athens was so infatuated with him at the time that the city took the official stance of these temple-based hookups being holy events. Anyway, Demetrius renewed his wars against both Ptolemy and Cassander the next year by marching into the Peloponnese, where various cities were held by garrisons from either of the Antigonids' rivals. Last time Demetrius attempted this, they told him to take his bribe money and leave. After the series of impressive victories over the last few years, neither the Antipatrid nor Ptolemaic officers in the region wanted to go up against the ever-growing Antigonid host. This time, they either surrendered outright or accepted the bribes and fled with barely any fighting to speak of, as Demetrius triumphantly marched across the whole region. In Argos, during a festival for the marriage goddess Hera, he took another wife, a Molossian princess. For once, Demetrius's love of getting married served a practical purpose, because it secured the largest Epirote kingdom on Macedon's western border as an ally against Cassander. In the fall and winter of 303 to 302, Demetrius was a busy man. He had more courtesans and prostitutes to take on temple dates, and he achieved contemplation in the Eleusinian Mysteries. In the spring of 302, Demetrius made his big play for victory in Greece. The Antigonids now controlled all of southern Greece, and it was time to march toward Macedon and the throne of the Agiad kings. They invaded Thessaly and began pushing back the last of Cassander's forces in Greece proper. Unfortunately for Demetrius' dreams of conquering his homeland, the invasion was poorly timed. Up in Thrace, Lysimachus had once again arranged an armistice with his Odrysian counterparts, and was now free to pursue imperial ambition. He cut a deal with Cassander. We don't know the details, but it was probably something along the lines of, "Hey, we share a border. Do me a solid, and I'll leave Thrace alone once we get this Demetrius kid out of my hair." It may have even been easier, just so long as Lysimachus got to screw with Demetrius. The king in Thrace despised his younger rival. Lysimachus was disgusted by Demetrius's sexual dalliances, and enraged by Demetrius's nickname for him. Demetrius refused to acknowledge the royal titles of his opponents, and instead he called Ptolemy the Admiral, Seleucus the Master of Elephants, Cassander the Regent, which is also what Cassander called himself, but so on. Lysimachus was the Treasurer, basically tongue-in-cheek references to the rules they could have had if only they bowed down and observed the Antigonid kings. Most of the others took this in stride and thought it was even a little funny to make light of their own positions. Lysimachus did not. Treasurers in Macedonian and Persian courts were eunuchs, and that was a bridge too far. Lysimachus crossed the Sea of Marmara with an army and invaded Hellespontine Phrygia with a sudden push into Antigonid territory. In dire need of a right-hand man without any warning, Antigonus Monophthalmos ordered his son to withdraw from Thessaly, leave whatever garrisons were necessary to hold Greece, and join him in Asia to fight Lysimachus. Sadly for them, Antigonus was down in Syria on the lookout for Ptolemy. Demetrius had to figure out an organized withdrawal, and responding would take time. Lysimachus used that time to surge through most of western Anatolia unopposed for a few months. By the time the Antigonids organized a response in spring of 301, it was too late to counter the latest development in Diadochoi warfare. Out of the east came the rolling thunder of thousands of gargantuan feet, accompanied by the trumpeting of hundreds upon hundreds of trunks. The Master of Elephants had arrived. But that will have to wait a couple of episodes. First, we need to explain how exactly Seleucus found himself in command of the largest elephant army we've seen so far. And for that, we need to make a stop over in India. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.